Welcome to the 350th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. Stay tuned for my interview with David W. Brown, author of the brand new book, The Mission. Stay tuned for the interview. The Reading and Writing Podcast is brought to you by Libro FM. Libro.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 185,000 audiobooks, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. You'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there, but you'll be part of a different story. One that supports your local community and your local bookstore. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. You can listen during your commute, while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from people who know audiobooks best, your local bookseller. Here's your special offer from the Reading and Writing Podcast. Get two audiobooks for the price of one today with your first month of membership with the code RWPODCAST at checkout. This offer is only valid for new members in Canada and the U.S. Check out Libro.fm today. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is David Brown, author of the new nonfiction book, The Mission, about an upcoming NASA space project to explore one of Jupiter's moons. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. Well, before we jump into the questions about this upcoming NASA space project, I do have to note that your book has one of the longest, most interesting subtitles that I'm aware of. And for the listeners, here's the subtitle of The Mission: How a Disciple of Carl Sagan, an ex-motocross racer, a Texas Tea Party congressman, the world's worst typewriter saleswoman, California mountain people, and an anonymous NASA functionary went to war with Mars, survived an insurgency at Saturn, traded blows with Washington, and stole a ride on an Alabama moon rocket to send a space robot to Jupiter in search of the second Garden of Eden at the bottom of an alien ocean inside of an ice world called Europa. A true story. So how did you and your editor decide on the subtitle?
Well, I was stridently anti-subtitle, and my editor wanted a subtitle with 5 or 6 words, and so we compromised at 83 words.
So did you end up coming up with it?
Right. I started after I eventually relented, as it was explained to me, how having a good subtitle helped sell the book or helped explain the title. I decided, well, if they want a subtitle, I'm going to give them one. And so I set about writing what I considered to be an honest subtitle. They say that an author's greatest challenge is living up to his or her subtitle. So I wanted there to be some truth when the reader gets to this book. They know exactly what they're getting. And the book is a yarn, and I felt like the subtitle should be one as well.
That's great. And what was their response when you sent them the subtitle?
To my editor's credit, he loved it. He had to go to bat for me with his superiors at the publishing house, and he did, and they eventually bought into it. It was pretty great of him.
That's great. Well, your book, The Mission, is about an upcoming NASA space mission to explore Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. Can you explain the basics of the planned mission? When is it supposed to launch, and what will the mission entail exactly?
So the mission is about the small team of scientists and engineers who spent 20 years trying to come up with this mission, trying to convince NASA to fly a spacecraft to Europa, which is an ocean moon of Jupiter. The spacecraft itself is going to launch in a 2025, let's say plus or minus 6 months. It depends on the rocket available. And it'll have a 6-year cruise phase to get to Jupiter. But what awaits the spacecraft at Jupiter itself is is a pulsing, rippling halo of death called the Jovian Radiation Belt, whose conditions are not unlike the immediate aftermath of a detonated thermonuclear bomb. The spacecraft, rather than marinate in that radiation, which is where Europa's engulfed, it's going to orbit Jupiter and encounter Europa multiple times.
When you say encounter Europa, so will it? You said it's going to circulate around Jupiter. Will it send out a probe to Europa? How's that going to work?
There are instruments on the spacecraft itself. So to make it simple, if you imagined we had a camera on the moon pointing at the Earth, or pointing at just a thin strip of the Earth, as the moon continuously circled the Earth, eventually it would get all sides as the Earth spun, as the moon made its way in its various strange orbit that it has. And Europa Clipper works a lot like that. The spacecraft will stay in Jupiter's orbit, and Jupiter's enormous. So it'll circle Jupiter, it'll take a while, and then it'll fly by Europa, and it'll scan one small strip of Europa, and then it'll fly away, and it'll point its antenna at Earth, it'll return all the data that it collected, it'll circle Jupiter again, and again, it'll fly by Europa again each time it orbits. Each time it does so in a different orientation. The effect of this is eventually it'll get a 360-degree view of Europa without actually having to go into Europan orbit, which would be enormously difficult because of the radiation.
Right, right. And so will it – what do they think about this? I'm just curious. Like, what is the lifespan, and do they plan on, like, what happens at the end, or will it just stay in – Jupiter's orbit? Do they plan the end? How does that work exactly?
The prime mission is going to characterize Europa, and that's going to take quite a while. Eventually, I mean, several years into this, so this spacecraft will last years, hopefully. I mean, unless something terrible happens. Eventually, they're going to have to decide what to do with it. Either it'll stay in Europa's orbit and act as stay in Jupiter's orbit and act as like a communications relay for some future spacecraft. Or maybe when it comes time to deorbit it, they won't crash it into Europa because Europa might have life. So instead, they would probably crash it into a different world or maybe into Jupiter itself. Personally, I'd like to see them crash it into Io, which is the most volcanically active body in the solar system. And it would be one heck of a fireworks show. We would see those images through to the end.
Sure. So a space project of this size takes years. How did you decide to write about this project? And what was the process for you to gain access to the NASA scientists and engineers working on this?
As a storyteller, I'm always on the lookout, obviously, for a good story, and certainly something with high stakes. When I first heard about the Europa mission, I realized almost at once that there's no human endeavor that has higher stakes than this. So what the spacecraft is searching for at Europa is habitability. Europa has all of the ingredients necessary for life, and not just ancient microbes that went extinct billions of years ago, but extant complex life today. Maybe microbes, but maybe fish. I mean, maybe sea monsters. How would humans approach that sort of life? So every living creature that you or I or any human ever to live or any animal ever to live has ever encountered has come from a single origin, some moment millions of years ago, where life came from lifelessness. When we look at Europa, that would be its own genesis. It would have its own moment where life came from lifelessness, totally unrelated to us. So it would be truly alien life. What would that mean to us in terms of religion, right? A second Garden of Eden. What would that mean to us in terms of philosophy, right? Are we alone? Where did we come from? And we would be able to really come to grips with those sorts of issues. And moreover, I think it's interesting to consider, how would we treat that life? I mean, whenever I go to a restaurant and eat fish, right, I've earned the right to eat that fish because my ancestors 100,000 years ago established the fish and the human's place on the food chain. But a fish on Europa, we certainly wouldn't have that understanding, would we? We wouldn't have earned anything. So would we even consider them animals? What does it even mean for humans to encounter another life form? These things are not, I mean, they're the domain of science fiction, but these are things that are going to be addressed in our lifetime. And it's important that we get started on that conversation.
Well, your book is a work of creative nonfiction where you go into the heads of the engineers and people that you write about. Why did you decide to write the book in that particular way?
Well, I knew right away the subject could be intimidating. This is a book about science and scientists for people who don't read books about science and scientists. And I wanted to make sure to sort of ground the story in very old storytelling methods, right? When you read this story, it should have a lyrical style. Creative nonfiction is very much bringing in the elements of fiction and the elements of poetry into your nonfiction in order to tell the story. I wanted the story to read as though it were being told aloud by a campfire, the way the Iliad might have been told, you know, for generations before it was actually written down. This book is the first time that story was written down. Accordingly, people need to bring nothing to the story. You need to have no education in astrophysics or biology. I certainly didn't. But you should still be able to read the story. You will read the story, and everything you need, you'll get from the story, both in terms of its style and also in terms of the way that this stuff is explained. If I did it right, the prose should almost feel like you could burst into song. It should be that lyrical.
And so given that, and I'm not sure that every science writer would characterize their writing the way that you just did, what was the writing process like for you to get the prose to a point where you feel like you know, it could be sung aloud or read next to a campfire?
I think, I'm not saying this in an arrogant way. I don't think a book like this has ever been written in the field of science, certainly not in planetary science. This is sort of breaking new ground. And I did very much want the reader to come away not only with the appreciation for what these people did, the people that I write about, but also a new appreciation for what nonfiction can do. The process for writing it took 7 years. It involved interviews with over 100 people. It involved reading more science papers than I care to think about. Science papers are not exactly beach reading, I can assure you. And it was an enormous task. I didn't know when I set out on this project just how difficult it would be. It might actually have scared me away, but I was so inspired by the story I was hearing that I wanted to make sure that I did justice to their life's work. So when you're reading this book, you're reading everything I've got. This is all I got in me. This is the culmination of my life's experiences. And so I gave them, I'd like to think, what they gave us.
Well, given all the very human problems that we face in the U.S., there's a contingent of people who frown upon the money spent on space exploration. I'm curious, given your work on this book and all that you learned about the team who worked on this project, what would your argument be for space exploration?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad you asked it. First, I do think that the argument that...
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, we have so many problems down here. Why are we spending money up there? I think it's a very disingenuous argument because it implies that we can't explore space until we've solved all the problems in the world. I mean, no human endeavor could ever meet such a threshold. But I also think there's a misconception or generally impoverished understanding of just how little money NASA gets. People might think it gets 25, 30% of the federal budget because of the extraordinary achievements that go into what NASA does and how visible they are and how consequential. We know on some, like in our marrow, that work is. In fact, NASA gets 0.5% of the federal budget. Planetary exploration gets a quarter of that. So Americans annually spend more money on chewable dog toys than they do on space exploration, as I've written about in the mission.
That's a good stat.
Yeah.
So what was the biggest obstacle in NASA? And as you just mentioned, the kind of budgetary constraints for the planetary exploration, what was the biggest obstacle in the Europa Clipper project?
Europa is uniquely positioned in the solar system in that, when I discussed the it exists in massive radiation, and it's very difficult for robots to get to. It's impossible for humans to get to. The radiation belt is that fierce, or the Jovian radiation belt is that fierce. So technologically, this is a non-trivial body to explore. Politically, there's no real gain by supporting space exploration, and certainly not exotic space exploration like that of Europa. No one ever won an election saying, I'm going to support this mission that's going to find fish in an alien ocean. At NASA, because they get so little money, if you're given the choice, do we explore Mars, where astronauts might one day walk? Or do we explore some place like Europa? But it could also be Titan, right? A moon of Saturn or Enceladus or wherever it might be. Do we go with the sure thing, or do we go with the maybe or the difficult or the in some cases impossible? And NASA wisely, I think, in a lot of instances, chose the easy. I mean, they are easy with an asterisk, of course. This is a relative statement. Because astronauts will one day walk on Mars, those robots, those rovers that we see, Perseverance rover that's going to land right in a couple of weeks, those are more than science missions. Those are human precursor missions. They're buying down risk for future astronauts. You can't say the same thing for Europa. You can't say the same thing for Titan, for example. So that was probably the most pressing challenge is overcoming that. But the stakes of the mission were so high that inevitably NASA decided we've got to do this thing. And the science community was in lockstep behind it. They wanted to see this body explored because of its life questions, but also there are some interesting questions of geology that get to be explained, and its cryosphere and just the nature of the Jovian radiation belt and what it does to a moon like that.
Well, you mentioned earlier that a rocket will lift the Europa Clipper into Earth orbit. And then I'm assuming it has its own rockets to get up from Earth to Jupiter.
So this particular spacecraft is going to work, it's almost certainly going to launch on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. That's a pretty big rocket. It's not big enough to send the spacecraft on a direct flight to Jupiter, though. The solar system's big and gravity's harsh, and it takes a lot of power to do that. So instead, what it's going to do is what's called a mega trajectory, MEGA. It's a Mars-Earth gravity assist. So what's going to happen is the rocket will launch, and it's going to fling the spacecraft to Mars. The spacecraft is going to take some of Mars's gravity and get slung around back to Earth, because remember, these planets are continually moving. The spacecraft will come back to Earth, fly by the Earth, pick up a whole bunch of Earth's gravity, and essentially gets slingshotted all the way to Jupiter. So wow. It's basically free fuel, but the pilot is going to be Isaac Newton.
That's amazing. And I'm wondering, I'm assuming that you have a sense of the size of this Clipper. So for the listeners, can you give us a sense? I mean, are we talking about the size of a car? We're talking about the size of an 18-wheeler. What's the dimensions of this satellite probe that's going to go to Jupiter?
The spacecraft itself, including the enormous solar panels that it's going to bring in order to be powered, is about the size of a basketball court.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Pretty big. That's great. Well, as you mentioned the SpaceX rocket that will most likely take it into Earth orbit. I'm curious, with the rise of SpaceX and Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin, both that are private rocket companies, what does the future of NASA look like? I'm curious if you got a sense of that and the research that you were doing for the book.
One of the great challenges that space exploration has always encountered, whether human or robotic, is the cost of access to space. It's hard to get to space, and it's expensive to get to space. SpaceX and Blue Origin and a handful of other private enterprises are lowering the cost, right? So suddenly, prices are coming down by an order of magnitude. That's enormously consequential for the exploration of the solar system, because suddenly you can, if in the case of human exploration, you can send a lot of cargo to Mars, which is going to be necessary, and you can do it for pennies on the dollar. You can send heavier spacecraft into space, or you can actually send spacecraft that could be assembled in orbit, for example. One mission proposal for Europa involved just such an enterprise. Europa Clipper does not, but that is something that's always a possibility. Likewise, multiple launches to build sophisticated space stations. I would call the development of reusable rocketry probably the most consequential development in space exploration since the Apollo program. It's seismic in terms of implication.
That's great. Well, I know that you have a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from the University of Arkansas at Monticello. What was your MFA experience like?
It was very good. The program was brand new at the time. The instructors and professors were very eager to establish something that was respectable, something that that was serious, something that was doing something new or innovative. I think they succeeded. Because it was new, I was an established writer at the time. One reason that I chose that particular place was because I didn't think they would ruin my writing style. I think the MFA experience can sometimes be detrimental to writers. So I would call it enormously positive. The workshop experience is always a little frustrating, right? And it's always hard to hear painful truths, and it's harder yet when you disagree with those comments. But my members of my cohort were wonderful. There was a mutual respect, and there was an appreciation. There was a love of the written word. And of course, a love of literature. And we got along famously. I'm still friends with most of them.
Great. And were you working then primarily on nonfiction, or were you working on fiction as well?
Well, my MFA is in creative writing with specializing in fiction. At the time, I was doing both. I was making my living writing nonfiction.
Right.
And creative nonfiction was something that was always on the radar, but ultimately I felt like what I was missing was a solid background and understanding of the devices of fiction. And of course that would, all of those things would apply to the nonfiction I would later write. I mean, I cannot overstate the value of that degree and that experience, but there is a novel in me. I've been working on one for a while. I've had to put it aside because I have another book that I have to write for my publisher after this one. So my next book beyond that will almost certainly be fiction.
That's great. Well, are you, you mentioned you're working on another book. Have you started it? Are you working on another book now?
It depends if my editor's listening. If he's listening, then absolutely. I'm very far along and things are going great. If he's not listening, I would say research on this project has been difficult simply because of COVID. So the types of interviews that I do are very patient. I mean, it takes a long time to build trust. It takes a lot of years to write these books. And it takes countless hours of conversations and, you know, talks over drinks and things like that to get people to put down the armor and reveal not just facts of their lives, but truths of their lives. You just can't do that by Zoom. It's just not something you can do remotely. It has to be in person. The pandemic has been devastating in that regard. I've been able to do a lot of great research in the meantime, but the process is going to take a while. Sure. It's going to be a great book. I'm very excited about this book. It's about expeditioners doing research in Antarctica, but yeah, it's going to take a long time, but it'll be worth the wait in the end.
Yep. Well, with the vaccines, hopefully it will happen sooner rather than later, of being able to talk to people over drinks.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are writing their own stories or novels or nonfiction?
I usually give writers the same advice. It's just read more. It's so easy to not read, particularly when you're on a deadline all the time. Freelance writers, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for over 12 years now. And there's never a day, not a single moment when I'm either not working or thinking about the work I have to do or thinking about pitches or thinking about, revisions or edits or whatever. But you've got to make time to read. You've got to add to your toolbox. It's just invaluable. Moreover, I would suggest don't worry about the career of writing when you're worried about your craft. You need to worry more about the words you're putting on the page and less about how the business works. I know a lot of people spend so much time worrying about things like query letters or reading, you know, literary agent scare blogs, but those things aren't helping you. I mean, nobody cares. I mean, that stuff really doesn't matter at the end of the day, as long as those first, you know, 10 pages or whatever, when you're pitching your novel or when you're submitting your novel or submitting your proposal for a work of nonfiction. That's the stuff that has to be rock solid and moving and poetic and eloquently written.
You're right about that. Well, in terms of reading, what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
I just reread Moby Dick. It's something that I read regularly because that's going to be a touchstone for the next book that I'm writing. But I've also been reading Kierkegaard. I've got Works of Love right here on my desk. I've got what else do I have right here? I've got The Pale King by David Foster Wallace. I've got Maggie Nelson's work, Bluets. Roddy Doyle's The Guts. These are just part of my regular reading. I can't say that I sit down and just knock out a book. Usually it's a little of this, a little of that, whatever takes my fancy. I'm a messy reader, I would say. Sure.
So where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your books?
I can be reached at davidwbrown.com. I'm on Twitter at @dwbwriter, WRITER, same at @dwbwriter for Instagram. And of course the book can be found at, you know, bookstores everywhere. Go to your local indie, go to your library and request it. Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all the usual places that sell books.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with David Brown, author of the new book, The Mission. The book is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And David, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Great.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.